I'm Carrie Brett, and this is Shot at Love. Today's guest is Dr. Gary Lewandowski. He's a professor, relationship scientist, author, and speaker who's given over 120 conference presentations and written articles for over 150 media outlets. Over 2 million people have viewed his TED Talk about breakups. His new book, Stronger Than You Think, opens readers' eyes so they can accurately and confidently view themselves when searching for a relationship they want. In this week's episode, we will discuss blind spots that undermine your relationship and how to see past them so we don't have to learn the hard way. When we come back, we'll talk about everything from science of heartbreak to why learning scientific data leads to better decision making and why breakups don't have to leave you broken because you're stronger than you know. Stay tuned. Dr. Gary Lewandowski has been featured as a relationship expert in hundreds of publications, including the New York Times, NPR, CNN, Time, Marie Claire, Men's Health, and Forbes, to name a few. He's also a professor and former chair in the Department of Psychology at Monmouth University. Dr. Lewandowski's research, writing, and public speaking focuses on romantic relationships, self, and identity. He recently published his first book, Stronger Than You Think, The 10 Blind Spots That Undermine Your Relationship and How to See Past Them. He also co-created the app Stay Go, which tells you whether it's time to commit or quit. Using this app, you can make informed decisions about your love life while deciding faster to stay or go. He's dedicated his life to helping people build resilience and find meaning in the face of adversity. It is my honor to welcome Dr. Gary Lewandowski. Hi, Gary. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really excited that you're here. This is the first time I've had a dating or relationship scientist here, which is going to be fascinating for people and especially me. And I discovered you from an interview that you did on the podcast, Save the Date, which was created by the CEO of Coffee Meets Bagel. And you talked about your TED Talk, so when I heard that, I looked you up, and I couldn't believe that you compared the Japanese art of kintsugi to being broken. And in your in your TED Talk, you said you could take damage and repair and make something beautiful. I also compared being broken to kintsugi on an episode that I did with John Fleming and Kieran Akal, the Chai Rum guys, and I thought it was such a random thing that we were talking about on the podcast. And I just, when I ever heard that, I thought, I've got to reach out to this person because we must think alike about a lot of things. And I could tell that you were a really nice person and that you truly cared about helping others. So,
yeah, well, you know, I guess it's not every day that people compare broken pottery to broken relationships. And so if you find two people that have done that, those two people should find a way to have a conversation.
That's right. So I'm an artist, so my information, different things that I pick up, I'm guessing is different than, say, science. Like art and science are a little different. But today I want to talk about your book and your TED Talk. And I have to tell people about the beginning of this TED Talk because it must have been nerve-wracking, but I love how you walk out on the stage and you ask the audience, how many of you have experienced a breakup or divorce? Can I see a show of hands? And then everybody puts their hands up. And then you say, can you please keep your hand up if you've survived that experience? And then everyone just starts laughing. And then you say, if you keep your hand up, you've learned something about yourself going through a divorce or a breakup. Can you talk about how you had this idea or what that experience was like or the Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, any of that? Just take us to that time.
Sure. You know, and so that they say, you know, research ideas come from a lot of personal experience. And, you know, I think that's often the case, right? I mean, you kind of come up with ideas or at least questions about how the world works by drawing upon some of your own experience. And, you know, as I even, I think, mentioned in the TED Talk, you know, I've had breakups and, you know, some of them have been bad, but actually some of them had been pretty good too. And so, you know, I'm like everybody else, I've lived through those experiences where, you know, I had a breakup that I thought was just like the end of the world. Like I thought it was all going to be over and, you know, this is not what I wanted or expected or any of those kinds of things. And so, you know, living through those experiences, you start coming up with ideas about what it means and what it could mean. And then you wonder if other people have the same kind of experience. And, you know, for most people, they just have to kind of wonder. But when, you know, you do science in the world of relationships, you don't have to just wonder. You get to be nosy and you get to ask a bunch of people. And so that's basically what I did.
Right. So you researched this group of particularly sad people. And I think, honestly, you could have done the whole case study on me during my breakup. But there's this devastated group. And I think it's 1 out of 3 considered a breakup negative. But but you also said that overall it was positive and it was almost like being paroled. Now you're free. Can you talk about that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is the thing with breakup is everyone just kind of assumes it's the negative experience. And you know, don't get me wrong, it is. I mean, even the best breakups, they're still a negative piece of it. But this is the thing is that most experience in our lives, I mean, they're not 100% bad or 100% good. And so breakup is no exception. And so there's a mix. And so, you know, you're absolutely right about the percentage, like 1 in 3 said it was negative. But what that means is the rest didn't consider it overall negative. And so what we actually found was about 40% considered their breakup overall positive. And as you pointed out, this was a group of people that should have been especially sad. These were people who had broken up generally within the last 3 to 6 months and hadn't found a new relationship. So they were single, they were alone, and it was still relatively fresh. So, you know, if anything, this was a group primed to not find the positives in this experience. And yet 4 out of 10 said, you know what, overall, this has been a good thing. You know, and if your math's good, you kind of know like the rest of them fell in the middle, right? I mean, if 1 out of 3 said negative, there's about 4 out of 10 that said it was positive. The rest basically said it was neutral, which is actually pretty darn good too, considering that, you know, they'd broken up recently and they were still single. And so, you know, we tend to think breakups are going to be worse than they are. And that's important to kind of get a hold on, because if we start thinking our breakups are going to be worse than they are, they can encourage us to stay in relationships longer than we should.
So what happens when people get out of an impoverished relationship? Can you talk about the addition by subtraction process? What happens?
Absolutely. And so, you know, a lot of the research I've done really focuses on this idea of self-expansion. And self-expansion is a person's motivation to become a better person, right? We seek out relationships to help us grow. And relationships, particularly romantic relationships, are one of the primary sources of self-expansion in our life. And so our romantic partner really takes a lot of the responsibility for helping us grow. And so if you're in a relationship with someone who's not doing that for you, they're not helping you grow, they're not helping you become a better person, by getting rid of them, it's essentially addition by subtraction. By losing this person that's kind of holding you back, you now have the opportunities to achieve that self-expansion that the previous relationship was preventing you from attaining.
Right. Well, I mean, I know myself, I wouldn't even have this podcast if it wasn't for the support of my boyfriend and encouragement. And it's been so, he like gave me the wings to fly, and he isn't threatened by, my producer's rolling his eyes, but he's rolling his eyes at me. But I feel that way because I had been held back before, and I'm always just honest about what I've been through. And because there was lack of information of how I could navigate a breakup and the pain, it took me a lot longer. And I think this is why I love your book so much, because like you said, you were able to find all these people in relationships and like wait for them to break up and then gather the data. And these are the things that you found, that people's lives weren't destroyed. They were, once they could get past the hard part, they could, you know, really expand and be happier than before. And to go back to your TED Talk, you say that relationships are the most important thing in your life. And it's the source of your best memories and your worst memories. But a breakup can also break you. And what have you learned from people who felt completely destroyed?
You know, if you weren't convinced about how important relationships are to our just everyday life, and more importantly, our sense of self, you can't not realize that after talking to somebody who's had a bad breakup, because even if they've ended what the outside world might consider a horrible relationship, that for that person, that breakup and that partner was a really big part of who they were. And so when you lose something that is that much a part of you, it's devastating. It's identity shifting. It's altering to your very core. You know, you said something about, you know, your partner has given you the wings to fly, but, you know, imagine if you feel like that and then those wings are taken away and now you just have to walk around, right? I mean, it's a very, you know, life altering experience. And so, you know, you really start to appreciate how important relationships are. And I think, you know, a lot of my early research was on breakup. And then, you know, partly, you know, the book that I've written recently touches on breakup, but also touches on just overall the importance of relationships. And what you see is when you see how badly a bad relationship and a breakup can hurt people, it really drives home the importance of having really strong relationships, high quality partners. And that, you know, that's something we really need to spend more time focusing on and dedicating our lives to.
Right. And so people think about it, like they research organic food or they research where they're going to go to dinner or whatever. And relationships affect our health, our emotional well-being, and our career. So it's proven that people sometimes get sick if they lose someone or they lose their job. They don't have the skills or the information to get through that tough time. And you felt that you could write a book that would educate people on the research you found. I was always someone who researched relationships so that I could avoid pain, and I was someone who made a lot of mistakes. Tell me, what was the true inspiration or the mission with your new book, Stronger Than You Think?
Yeah, I mean, what motivates me in almost everything that I do is trying to help people leverage all of the great information science has learned about important areas of our life and actually make it accessible and usable in their life. And when you think about, you know, some of the areas that are super important to everyday life, you know, as you point out, relationships are one of them. And, you know, the former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy basically says, you know, loneliness and bad relationships are as bad for your health as smoking, right? I mean, it's that important in some way. So trying to help people, yeah, I'm a relationship science. I've been doing, you know, relationship science for 20, 25 years. And I know how much good information is sitting out there in journals that are hard to read, hard to find, and expensive to pay for. And yet we all acknowledge that relationships are important. And so, you know, I really try to write this book to help bridge that gap, to take some of the best science that we have, at least the most useful science that we have, to help people just lead better relationships. Because I think a lot of times, you know, in perfectly good relationships, people aren't always appreciating what they have. And you know, there's a lot of sort of, you know, happiness and fulfillment left there out on the table, so to speak, where, you know, they're not really optimizing their relationship experience in the way that they can. So they're actually at risk for losing good partners. And well, so, you know, it's almost the flip side of breakup in a lot of ways.
Right. So what you did was you invited others into your lab and you had them rediscover themselves. What helped and what information did you find when you did that?
Sure. And so this is what, you know, when people are dealing with breakup, you know, you're trying to look to see, you know, what kinds of things can we do for people and study this in a scientific way to see what might actually help people. And, you know, one of the things that we thought was going to help people was having them do some new, interesting and challenging activities, right? You know, go out and try some things you've never done before, pick up a brand new hobby. That's really going to help. But we also thought, well, let's compare that to something relatively close. And what we decided to compare those new, brand new activities to were activities that were kind of new. And what I mean by that is these were activities that people had done before their relationship, but because of their relationship, they kind of set them to the side, kind of minimized their role in their life. Or, you know, maybe you had been an artist before your relationship, and because your relationship partner didn't like it, you just stop painting and you stop doing some of those things while you're in your relationship. And so what we said to that group of people was, you know, let's identify some of those types of activities and now, like, take the opportunity to rediscover those, like reinvigorate those interests, reinstitute some of those hobbies and interests, and try those things. And then we had a third group that just, we said, carry on normal, right? Just kind of do your normal thing. And we actually, to be honest, walked into that study thinking it was the new activities that were going to be the best. But it turned out it was the rediscovery of the self. It was going back to those things that had been you before you were with your partner. And in retrospect, after the fact, it made perfect sense. Because, these were activities that people already knew that they liked. They were already central to their sense of self and identity. And so it helped people remind themselves about the kind of person they were before they met their partner. Right. And that was, a full, important, vibrant person as well. Those new activities were helpful, more helpful than nothing. But the problem with some of the new activities was, people would try a new activity and realize they hated it. Right. And so, like we had somebody who, they were determined, what they wanted to try brand new was horseback riding.
Okay.
We had them kind of, keep like little logs of their activities and things. And what that person realized was when they got on a horse, the horse bit them and they didn't like horseback riding as much as they thought they were.
Oh, wow.
Right.
But and like, so, metaphorically, it's like, get back on the horse,
Right. It was like, all I want to do is ride a horse. And it didn't work out for them. There's a little bit of, uncertainty, I guess, with brand new activities. They were still better than nothing, like I said, but it was those rediscovery things that really helped people the most.
That's good. Well, I think when you're busy and you're doing something new, you have to concentrate. So you can't run those negative storylines 24/7. And I would think the people who were just destroyed and completely heartbroken, their whole life was built around someone else, and their life was nothing about them. And so that's when that loss of identity you talk about really comes through very strongly, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we know when people are entering relationships, they start overlapping their sense of self and their identity with their partner. It's something we call inclusion of other in the self. Mm-hmm. And then as that relationship takes hold, your overlap becomes so substantial where you actually have a hard time, disentangling where you begin and I end off. And, it's less about me and you and more about we and us, right. Where we start asking you questions about you and say, how much do you enjoy going for walks on the beach? And people that have high inclusion of self in an ongoing relationship will say, well, we really like it. But, we're just talking to one person. But they're so ingrained with, their sense of self with their partner that they just automatically think of everything as a we and us kind of thing. So you can imagine if you're, mentally overlapped and merged with your partner to such an extent that, you're thinking of yourself that way, that when you lose that person, part of who you are can potentially go with it. And so, when you lose that big chunk of yourself, finding ways to fill in the blanks is really important. And that's where that rediscovery process we found to be really helpful.
Yeah. So I didn't even know about that. What is it called? The
inclusion of other in the self?
Yeah. Had I known that term, that would have been helpful to me. But I didn't know that. So I think people have this loss of identity, but they also have, and I know myself, if I invest a lot of time into anything and then I lose it or it doesn't work out, I'm angry about that amount of time and effort.
Yeah. Well, it becomes such a big, our sense of self is so important to every last aspect of everything we do in our lives. And so, when you've devoted that sense of self to a particular activity or a person, and to the extent that you've overlapped and merged with that into your part of your identity, a loss of, that activity is a loss of part of who you are. Which also speaks to why it's not such a bad idea to diversify your sense of self instead of, putting your whole entire self into one entire thing. That's potentially fantastic, but it's also potentially risky.
Right, definitely. So we're going to talk about different blind spots. So you have in your book, Stronger Than You Think, the 10 blind spots that undermine your relationship and how to see past them. And so I want to definitely talk about this because I know it's going to help a lot of people. In your research, there was a lot of common things people did when they were deciding if they should stay or go. Can you talk about how difficult this internal conflict is when making this probably the most important decision of their life?
Sure. One of the things when people find out that I study relationships, people will kind of in a tongue-in-cheek or joking way say, well, relationships are kind of easy, aren't they? But the fact of the matter is, if relationships were so easy, people wouldn't break up and people wouldn't have as many troubles and complications and drama as they do. And, we wouldn't have dating apps, right? There's a lot of things that we wouldn't have. But it's because, the fact of the matter is relationships are tough. They're hard to navigate. And part of what makes them so hard is that we have a lot of doubts and there's a lot of things that push and pull us in different directions. And so that particular research we're talking about is from Sam Joel and colleagues, some Canadian relationship scientists. And what they basically, they do a lot of research looking on the decision-making process in relationships. And so they ask people about how much they want to stay in the relationship and what are some reasons to stay. And then they also ask them for reasons that they should go. And what they found is there are 27 reasons to stay and 23 reasons to go. And so, that's kind of that's a tough split, right? I mean, because we like things to be a lot clearer than that, right? And so, there's that ambiguity, right? And it goes back to something I said earlier is that, nothing's kind of 100% one way or the other. It's not, even the world's worst partner has a few redeeming qualities. And even the world's most ideal partner has a few things that you might like to be different. Despite having doubts, roughly half of all the participants had an above average inclination to stay. Right. And so they were conflicted basically. Like they had a bunch of reasons to stay and a bunch of reasons to go. But when you ask them like, well, are you going to stay or are you going to go? They said, over half of them said, no, I'm going to stay. But those same exact people that had an above average inclination to stay also had an above average inclination to go. Right. So, they could basically convince themselves in both directions that maybe I should stay, maybe I should go. And, I use that study as sort of the first big study that I talk about in the entire book, because I think this study does a really nice job of doing a couple things. And the first is just showing all the different considerations that people make when they're kind of thinking about their relationship, right? I mean, there's the, 27 plus 23, there's like 50 things at least. Mm-hmm. And so, when I came up with the 10 blind spots for the book, I relied very heavily on those 50 considerations and basically took the greatest hits for the blind spots in the book. And I also start off the book with that because it really just shows how confusing relationships can be and how much doubt is just a natural part of relationships. And how, I think a lot of the doubt that people have in their relationship comes from just not knowing that much about relationships, right? Experience isn't the same thing as expertise.
Right. I love that one.
As much as you can have, for one person, I don't know what's considered a lot of relationships, but it's still not nearly as many relationships as we can touch in one relationship science study, right? And so, right. We're always going to learn more from doing a research study than we are from one person's individual experience.
Right. Well, it's funny because I listened to some interviews that you've done and you would ask questions like, say, well, not like you were tricking someone, but you would be like, do you think, and I always had the right answer. And I was like, I'd love that because it was just funny to me because I have a lot of experience, but I don't mm-hmm. have the data. And you have a test within your book about power in relationship. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because I did that test with my boyfriend and we didn't even know what end was up pretty much through the whole thing because my answer was always the opposite of his. And mm-hmm. he was like, you have all the power. I'm like, you have all the power. So I was kind of laughing about that because it just showed that it was that we were equal, that we weighed each other's. There wasn't one person just driving the bus. That we were sure. working together as a team. But I do think these questions and all the different things that you have in your book are super helpful. And so one of the big blind spots in your list of the top 10, the hits, the greatest hits, like you say, mm-hmm. is that people are generally persuaded or led by attractiveness. Why do we put so much value on beauty and why is this not a good thing?
I think we put a lot of emphasis on beauty because it's easy, right? I mean, like every armchair psychologist in the world likes to come up with, you know, hey, that person's got these kinds of eyes and it makes, you know, they have kind eyes. They have curious eyes. They, you know, we like to just kind of infer a lot of personality information from other people's appearance, right? So it could be their physical features. It could be how they dress. It could be how they wear their hair, you know, all kinds of things, because we like on some level to have the inside scoop, to kind of have some special privileged information about others. And so the easiest thing to know about another person when you don't know anything at all is how they look. And so, you know, it just kind of starts there. Like, I think there's just that natural draw. The other thing is that's really working, you know, against this in some ways is our own brain. I mean, your brain processes another person's attractiveness in milliseconds. So even if you decide, you know, I read this chapter and I'm not going to let attractiveness sway me as much, you almost can't help it, at least initially, right? Like, so when you look at someone who's attractive, you know, you're going to see a beautiful person as beautiful. You're going to see, you know, a hot guy as a hot guy. Like, there's just, your brain just automatically registers such a thing. But, you know, what the benefit is of, you know, that particular chapter is just to really, really emphasize how it's not a winning characteristic necessarily for a relationship. And so a lot of people want this super attractive partner because it's, you know, it's appealing, like, why, you know, on some level, why wouldn't you? But it's not something that's actually going to benefit your relationship in and of itself if you're looking for long-term, stable, happy, healthy relationships.
Wow. So you have this study where you have people view photographs to judge attractiveness. Can you tell us what the halo effect is?
Sure. And so what happens with the halo effect, you know, it sounds kind of angelic, but it's really just the stereotype where you think once somebody is attractive, that's like one good quality. And the idea with the halo effect is that one good quality kind of casts this golden glow over the entire person. So once you see them as attractive, you also start thinking, well, they must be a good person. They must be nice. They must be honest. You know, there's a very famous study in social psychology where they talk about, you know, it's the halo effect, and they also call it the what is beautiful is good effect. And, you know, they show people these pictures, and some are attractive and some aren't. And people think that the attractive person is going to be the better parent, the better marriage partner, better in bed, and all those, you know, types of great qualities.
Right. More successful, better job.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. Only that it's not true. Right. I mean, those things. You know, your hot partner isn't necessarily the better husband or wife or long-term relationship partner. And I mean, those things just aren't related in the way that we think they are. Because again, you know, I think we just are inclined to, it's easy and it's simple and it's kind of a mental shortcut. But it happens to just not be true.
Well, I've never heard that term before. And I think all these different studies are so fascinating. And you said in your book that most people look for someone who's 25% better looking than them.
Right.
And so, say, an attractive woman that they thought was better looking would potentially lose interest or be more apt to cheat. Or, say, the woman thought she was less better looking than she tend to focus her life around diet and maintaining being very thin or perfect. And anything else that you found in that study?
Yeah. And so, you know, what happens with this is, you know, we all kind of want to date out of our league a little bit. Right. And so that particular study you're talking about, the 25%, that was with online dating. And so, you know, when people are online dating, they're really, you know, saying yes to the matches, people who are more attractive than them. And as you said, by about 25%, because, you know, on some level, again, who wouldn't want this attractive partner? But, you know, what I'm pointing out in the book is, let's say you're successful with this strategy and you're able to land this partner who's 25% more attractive. Is this even a good thing? And it's not. You know, having mismatched couples, you know, where one's hot and the other's not, it leads to instability. And it encourages these like really bad tactics. So if you know your partner is more attractive than you, you're now constantly kind of worried and about them potentially cheating on you or other people hitting on them, right? So it increases jealousy. And so you try to almost block them from encountering some of these other, you know, alluring possibilities by monopolizing your partner's time, putting down other competitors, some emotional manipulation. You might even try to make your own partner jealous so that they're worried about you finding somebody else. And so, you know, just you got what you wanted. You got this more attractive partner, but you also got a bunch of other things you didn't necessarily bargain for or think far enough ahead about.
Right.
And so that's a problem.
Right.
And, you know, as you point out, you know, the women, when they're the more attractive partner in the relationship, if there's going to be a partner who's more attractive, it's better for it to be the woman. But it's also problematic in terms of, you know, the women start worrying too much about their appearance and dieting and those kinds of things. And it's the one kind of like really fun attractiveness finding is that, you know, when people are in happier relationships, they tend to be a little bit overweight.
You also had some research about being out of shape, and that is better. It's better to be a little out of shape, because if you're in a healthy relationship, then you feel secure about yourself. So can you tell us why relationships could be bad for our waistlines?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of, you know, a lot of time, you know, think about what happens when you're single and you're looking for a partner. I mean, you're putting out your best possible version of yourself. And so, you know, if you're about to hit the dating scene, you're going to make sure you're hitting the gym, you're toned, you're dieting, you're in the best possible shape you can have. So it's kind of the opposite if you're in a stable, healthy relationship. Like if you're very much in love and very much committed and you're going to be with this partner forever, you know, I mean, of course there's reasons to be healthy in and of themselves, but you know, you don't have that extra motivation of needing to attract potential partners. And so, you know, it suggests, you know, the a little bit, you know, of a bad waistline suggests a certain level of comfort and security in a relationship, which, you know, in a lot of ways, what I argue in the book a lot is this is what we want. This is what relationships are for, is for comfort, stability, and security. And so, you know, if you're constantly worried about, you know, does my partner like how I look? And, you know, are they going to leave me if I'm not attractive enough? I mean, that's a really bad situation.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no peace there.
Right.
There's absolutely no peace. So it's like you say, well, you got what you wanted. You got this super hot, high maintenance headache, in a sense.
Right.
and it's basically something you call fatal attraction. You had this Bridgewater survey. Can you tell me about this? Because I love this survey. And it was about this woman did a survey of men in high school, like the babes, and she followed their lives. Can you talk about that?
Sure. And so, you know, you think being attractive is going to be helpful, but what we find is, so that particular study, the yearbook study, you know, looked at high school photos and they rated them for attractiveness. And so what they found was when they tracked those people over time, people who were hotter in high school experienced more divorce. And, you know, they also found the same thing with celebrities, you know, more attractive celebrities have the same kind of problem. And so, you know, it ends up being one of those problems where you think, like, who wouldn't want to be the most attractive and if this is going to be great for my relationships? And it's a real destabilizing factor a lot of times.
Yeah.
You know, the solution, you know, so just so you know, we don't go too far overboard with this, you know, it's, if you're a 9 out of 10, it's not like, you know, the solution is like, well, you know, make yourself a 6. I mean, you don't have to do that. What you want to do is if you're a 9 out of 10, you find another 9 out of 10. And so if you're both 9s out of 10s, then you're even. Right. And so you have that match.
Right.
And it's something we call the matching hypothesis. And so to the extent that you and your partner are matched on attractiveness, your relationships are more stable. There's less jealousy. There's less inclinations to cheat. You know, it's just a much better overall kind of situation.
This episode of Shot at Love is brought to you by Akal Chai Rum. Akal Chai Rum is the world's first botanical rum, recognized by the government of Trinidad and Tobago as having the first new production process for rum in over a century. Akal Chai Rum is an officially protected trade secret, only the second such protected process in the Caribbean since the famed Angostura Bitters by Don Carlos Seagert in the 1870s. Akal Chai Rum is available in 44 U.S. states on chairum.com, also available in the Republic of Ireland on Stuff You Need. .ie. Try some today.
Well, I want to talk about this dark triad, because narcissists, you know, women can be initially swept up and taken by the confidence of a narcissist, but a narcissist may not be better looking than, say, the woman, but his inflated sense of self, you know, thinks he's better looking than he is. And I love your analogy of the flight instructor who jumps out of the plane. And can you talk about that? Because that is the perfect analogy of an unhealthy relationship.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the jumping out of a plane is, it's exciting, right? Like who doesn't want to do that on some level, right? I mean, assuming safety aside.
I don't, but I'm afraid of heights, so. But go ahead. I'm with you. I love it.
Nonetheless, you know, the part of the reason why is it's exciting, right? I mean, like, what's more thrilling than, you know, getting a chance to jump out of a plane on some level? But, you know, it's more about what it does to you, you know, almost, you know, physiologically. It's like your heart's racing, it's exciting. There's this nervous tension before you jump, and there's this excitement and tension before you land. And so, you know, a lot of times falling in love is a lot like that. Like, you know, it's this high wire act where, you know, when you're initially falling in love, you have all these really, really strong emotions, and you're not 100% sure if the other person reciprocates or how they feel or where this is going to go, how it's going to turn out. And so there's just all kinds of excitement. And so the point I make in the book, though, is that as much as that's really exciting, and in a lot of ways, this is what we're after, those passionate love kinds of feelings, they're just not sustainable. You can't maintain that level of high wire excitement throughout 20 years of a relationship. It's just really, really difficult to do, and time consuming, most likely. And so, you know, that's just not, as much as that sounds exciting, perhaps, it's we habituate to almost anything, right? And so the other thing I point out with that is, as much as your partner is exciting, and, you know, if maybe it does feel like jumping out of a plane, or maybe something a little less exciting, like a roller coaster, your instructor who's strapped to your back when you're jumping out of a plane, they're not freaking out at all, because they've done this enough times. And so they've habituated, they've adapted, they've gotten used to it. And that's exactly what's going to happen in your relationship. Even the very best relationships, people start getting freaked out that, you know, a year or 2 years down the road, they're just not getting butterflies the same way that they used to. But what people need to realize is that's an unrealistic expectation. You know, it's one of those blind spots where we tend to overemphasize the importance of that feeling without realizing that that feeling is always going to go away, right? We get used to things really fast.
Right.
It's just how we're wired.
Yeah. It's all fun and games until you hit the ground. And, you know, it's just, unless you've lived through that, I don't know if anyone can really appreciate that analogy as much, but those types of relationships are like crack cocaine, but they're not sustainable. They're like a mixture of like heroin and McDonald's. Like, it's never going to be good for your body.
Yeah, like a not so happy meal, right?
All right. So we covered looks. I want to talk about personality. And I think my listeners would be super interested in why you discovered the data around why a person's personality makes you more attractive.
Sure. I mean, this is another one of those. This is a study I did and was completely based on my own dating experiences where, you know, I mean, you'd have those dating experiences where, you know, you meet somebody who's like super, super attractive. And that's great for, you know, the immediate term. But then as you get to know them and you really start to learn about their personality, you realize like, oh my gosh, this person is just not a good person. Like they have all these problems and all these things, like they're materialistic and they're dumb and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And what I found in my own life was that, you know, when I found out those kinds of things about their personality, it actually made them less attractive. But I also found out, you know, found the exact opposite too. Like there were people that, you know, weren't, you know, tens out of tens, you know, they weren't models, but then their just personality was just so amazing that they became more attractive. And so, basically, you know, took that premise into the lab and, you know, found complete support for that idea that, you know, personality goes a long way, that, you know, when you first see somebody and then later find out that they're, you know, have all these fantastic qualities, they become more attractive.
Right.
Not just the personality becomes more attractive, but like you actually see them physically as more attractive. But the opposite is true as well, is that if you see somebody who's attractive and you find out bad things about them, they actually, you see them later as less physically attractive.
It's so true. You know,
it's literally like one of the favorite study I've ever done, I think, because it just, it's so incredibly fair.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, how often is life this fair?
I know. Well, I think that's why your personality came through in the TED Talk. And I think that's why you got over 2 million views, because, you know, you drew stick figures and diagrams when you were trying to explain the information. But, you know, you really used your personality in that talk. And it wasn't like you were just a scientist with these lists of studies. Like, you used your personal stories and your personality to relay that information. And I think that's why it was so successful. So... I want to talk about opposite attracts, and how likely are people to choose the opposite of them?
In the short term, it's possible. But what we like to say in relationship science is opposites may attract, but eventually they attack. And so, you know, that person, if you're, you know, let's take something that's like a true opposite, right? Like, you know, you're very introverted, you know, that highly extroverted partner might seem appealing, because it's like, you know, maybe you want to be a little bit more like that person. And so in the short term, maybe that's okay. But the fact of the matter is, we don't change very easily as people. And so as much as you maybe want to aspire to be more extroverted, that's probably not going to happen in the way that you want. And so you're going to still end up with the opposite kind of partner. And so, you know, when you on a Saturday night want to, you know, stay at home and you know, just chill, your partner's going to go out and see people. And maybe that's probably going to be the last thing you want to do. And so over time, those opposite features lead to conflict. Because, you know, you take another opposite, and I think I use this one in the book, is, you know, you like going to the beach and your partner hates the beach, right? I mean, that's opposite, right? But, you know, in a relationship, we kind of know we have to make sacrifices. So your partner that hates the beach still goes to the beach with you, but they don't enjoy themselves, and you know they're not enjoying themselves, but they're still doing it. And so as much as people will try to make it work, it's just not as harmonious as if you both liked the damn beach, right? Like, if you both liked it, there's just going to be infinitely less conflict. There's going to be less, you know, problems associated with simple activities. And so you kind of extrapolate that out to all the other areas of your life. And so as much as people will say, oh, you know, my partner and I, we're opposite on these things. And yeah, I mean, two people, you're going to have a couple of opposites. But if you look at the totality of all the things that you are and your partner is, you guys are a lot more similar than you're different, most likely.
Right, right. Okay, so my last question is about power within the relationship. And I think this is really important for people who are handing their power over online, which I know a lot of people. I've done it myself. Mm-hmm. And it's lack of information, lack of all this, the data and science that you have. The person who has more power is mm-hmm. less interested. And typically, men fill that role. Mm-hmm. And I know you have this principle of lesser interest. What is that?
So the principle of lesser interest is the person who needs the relationship the least. Right. That means that's they're less in, they have less interest in the relationship wins, and it wins in the sense of they have more power. And so you can imagine this as the person who doesn't need the relationship, you know, when there's some point of conflict about, you know, maybe one partner needs to move for their job and the other person doesn't want to move. The person who has more power can basically say, you know what, if you do this, I'm going to leave you. And they mean it. Right. And so they tend to get their way. And it's a problem, because, you know, in the best relationships, we should have equal power and share power and be equal partners. But when you have less interest, you're more willing to kind of exert that power and make decisions and have more influence and those types of things.
Right. And so that person is never going to, if that person has the power, once they don't have the power, like, you can't put someone on a pedestal forever. Like,
right.
you can't live your life for someone else forever. So that is one of those unsustainable things. So you can be in a relationship with someone who has all the power, but it's just not going to be long-term. Do you think that's right?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and I think some people, and as you kind of pointed out quite appropriately, is that, you know, the high power position tends to be men, particularly in our society, right? And so you can find women in heterosexual relationships who are quite convinced that this is okay. I don't care that he makes all the decisions. I'm easygoing. I don't care about making decisions. I don't care about any of those things. I'm perfectly fine with this. And that sounds good and possible in the short term. But that starts to get really old after a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, you know, et cetera. And so the problem is a lot of times it does get old. And then the person who was allegedly perfectly fine without having power decides they want to have more of a say. And, you know, in some ways, to be fair to the person who always had power, like, they're now like the other person's changing the rules. Like, this is not the arrangement that we had. This is not, you know, the rules of our relationship game that we were playing by. And so now all of a sudden you want something very different. And that can be really, you know, destabilizing to a relationship.
Right. Well, you talk about, now I try to give the information for women to protect themselves so that they have the power and they hold their cards to their vest. And you say, you know, if you, it's not a good thing to start off a relationship by playing games, but I feel like if women don't operate like they can take or leave somebody, then they are going to have a more challenging time online.
Yes.
Just in the beginning.
I think in the beginning and throughout the relationship, but I think there's a difference though of that doing that authentically is absolutely the way to go. I think doing it as like a tactic or a strategy starts, you know, isn't horrible, but there's potential problems there depending on how strategic you're actually being, if that makes sense.
Right.
Like, so if you're kind of holding your cards and not relinquishing your power because you have a clear, confident view of who you are and you're an authentic person with a strong personality who's not looking to other people to define them, to make decisions for them, and, you know, you're kind of in charge of your own journey, then you wouldn't have to, you see what I mean? Like, it wouldn't have to be a strategy then. Then you're just kind of, you know, you're going to hold ground and do your thing.
Right.
You know, I think it has to be a strategy when you haven't done the work on yourself and you're kind of faking it until you make it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that, I think, you know, that can be problematic.
Great. Well, that's really good advice. So, Gary, thank you so much for teaching us the importance of our role in relationships while sharing what's helpful as well as harmful in our selection process. Where can people find out more about you or purchase your new book?
Sure. The easiest way to find me is on Twitter or Instagram at Lewandowski, PhD, or on my website, www.garylewandowski.com.
Okay, great. And what about your new book?
Same thing. Website's probably the best, you know, GaryLewandowski.com.
Okay.
Or, you know, if you Google Stronger Than You Think book, it should be the first thing that comes up.
Okay. Well, I'm telling you, you've got to run out and buy this book. It's amazing. I think it's a dating Bible, honestly. It's phenomenal. And congratulations on it. It was
Thank you.
Great. I loved it. And I loved having you on the show and the time you gave me today. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to be back. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye. And for now, this week's Tinder Tips. And in honor of today's guest, Dr. Gary Lewandowski, these tips are inspired by him. Number one, remember the Ralph Waldo Emerson quote, "Our greatest glory is not in never failing, but in rising up every time we fail." Number two, a common thing women do is accept bad behavior from men because we think all men are like this. Guess what? They're not. Number three, often it isn't the case of love at first sight in the beginning, and the research has shown that people can grow on you, so don't forget, personality goes a long way. I hope you found some of my tips helpful this week. This is what Shot at Love is here for. To help you find love. Keep up the commitment to yourself and commit to helping someone else by sharing this podcast. Remember to stay safe and stay tuned for more episodes. I want to thank FeedSpot for naming Shot at Love Top 10 in Dating Podcasts. If you like this show, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. I'm Carrie Brett, and we'll see you next time.